Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Well, we've reached an important milestone with these Peak Prosperity podcasts. Today's marks our 100th interview, and I can't think of a better person to mark this achievement than today's guest. It is my great honor to welcome Dr. Ron Paul as my guest. Until the beginning of this year, Dr. Paul served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, beginning his first term of office in 1976. He ran for the office of U.S. President three times, most recently in the 2012 Republican primaries. Dr. Paul also had a long career as an OBGYN, over which he delivered over 4,000 babies. Ron Paul is a leading voice for limited constitutional government, low taxes, free markets, sound money, civil liberty, and non-interventionist foreign policies. I have long wanted to discuss our national situation with him, and I am delighted and honored he agreed to be our guest today. Dr. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Well, let's begin with the state of the economy. From my perspective, we have an imprudent and unsustainable monetary policy, which is creating all sorts of malinvestment, dangerous asset bubbles everywhere. Add to that a broken fiscal policy that has made America far too dependent on borrowed money, present company excluded. DC seems incapable of understanding the scope of the issues, let alone enacting steps to address them. Wall Street pursues moral hazard with impunity. What am I missing here? Do you see things differently?
Well, I see them differently in some way. I think the analysis is correct, but I see Washington as being different in the sense that I don't expect anything else because they're reflecting what I consider prevailing attitudes. And the prevailing attitudes for the last 50 or 60 years, especially since the 30s, has been that spending and deficits and printing money is the way to go. These people actually believe that World War II ended the Depression, and they have no idea that the Federal Reserve had something to do with the inflation of the 20s and the Depression of the 30s and the wars that are being fought. So they operate with deep conviction. You take a guy like Paul Krugman or even Bernanke, they believe it like a religion that spending is good no matter what the spending is on, and that deficits don't matter. Deficits are not a burden. And even though we have this national debt and we have a foreign debt, they don't consider that so bad as long as people will spend money. And if the people won't spend any money, the government has this moral obligation to do it. And we see it, you and I and others see it, what the results are. It's miserable. People are getting poorer. I mean, since the recession, depression hit in 07, the middle class has shrunk. They're probably 50% down on their income, yet the wealthy are getting wealthier. So it is a mess. It reflects a bad attitude about economics. It's been ingrained in our system, and that's what Washington is all about. But where I'm encouraged is outside of Washington, you get a better perspective from people like you who talk about this and get people to look at their investments. I think this is beneficial because there's a lot of people are realizing this whole system is deeply flawed, and they're looking elsewhere, and that's why I talk a lot about free markets and property rights and Austrian economics and getting rid of the Fed. All these things are now up for grabs. A lot of people, especially the young people, are looking at this. So for this reason, I'm a bit encouraged by, what might come out of this. But I think we're going to go through the ringer. I think it's going to get much, much worse, and it's bad enough already, but there's no way that we can step back. The one thing I'm convinced of after having spent so much time in Washington is that this will not be a gradual recovery from this disaster that we have. We're not going to elect enough people and enough courage to vote the right way, and there's too much demagoguing and too much misunderstanding that people would revolt. But the collapse will come, it's going to hit the dollar, and then we're going to have our opportunity. So the more people who are protected intellectually as well as financially, the better off we'll be in rebuilding what we'll have, what we'll need to do in the near future.
Well, that's exactly the work that we're engaging in out here as one of many organizations, as you mentioned, who've seen the light, who understand the real risks. And And I've noted a very pronounced, what I'll call generational gap, where, and I sympathize with both sides, boomers desperately want to preserve the status quo because they've paid into it, they've invested in it, they've saved into that system. They have everything to gain by preserving the status quo, but young people look at the same situation and say they have nothing to gain from preserving the status quo. That is, they get saddled with huge debts, a crumbling infrastructure, and, you know, no loyalty with companies and the government anymore. It seems, how do we close that gap up?
Well, reality will set in, and I think that's what's happening. The young people are leaving college right now. They have a degree that's not earning them a good job. Some of them are going to work at McDonald's, and then they have this huge debt. So it's a failed system, and they wonder what's wrong. Maybe government needs, we need to give them more money. We need to bail them out. But I heard Krugman say the other day, you know, what we need to do is put more people on food stamps because it's a net benefit to put more people on food stamps. Not be more productive and not save money and not invest and not, have free markets and sound money. No, put more people on food stamps. They'll spend the money, increase demand, and the world will be perfect again. So, but I think the young people are waking up. Just think about 5-6 years ago. How many people even talked about the Federal Reserve? How many, you know, we ended up, even though it's nothing to really brag about, but we ended up getting audit the Fed bill passed twice in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. Just getting it to the floor is pretty amazing. I had worked on that for 30 years, and there's always been somebody around complaining about the Fed and why we should know more about the Fed. And yet now it has shifted. And I can go to the college campus and get a good reception when I go hard on both the income tax and the Federal Reserve. So attitudes are changing, and I think the young people are realizing that they're getting a bad rap, and I think we have to turn that into a positive.
I totally agree. Now, I want to turn back to Bernanke for a second, because you've exchanged words with the man, certainly on your...
A few times,
and I've seen many of those exchanges. So what I'm interested in, you mentioned before that people in D.C. and people who are supportive of the whole D.C. culture, you've mentioned that they really believe in the narrative that they've told themselves, that deficits don't matter, things like that. So you've exchanged blunt words with Chairman Bernanke and the Federal Reserve monetary policies. Now, do you really think that he and the Federal Reserve Board are really aware of the risks that you've raised, or do they actually believe what they're saying?
I think they believe it less strongly than they used to believe. But they're protecting themselves, because they'll never admit, you know, I screwed up. You know, I worked in college for 30 years. I did my dissertation. Mm-hmm. This is my religious belief, and I put that in quotes. This is what I deeply believe. So what are they going to say when the whole thing comes down on the head? Well, it wasn't their fault. It was, right now they're starting to say, well, it's a fiscal problem now. The Congress just won't spend enough money. Oh, they, you know, raise taxes are too high. So they'll dismiss the blame away from them and not think it's monetary policy. But it's really both. It's both. You know, you can't have deficits without the Fed. And I've accused Bernanke as well as Greenspan as they were the facilitators. They're the ones who run up the debt. What if the Fed couldn't buy government debt? Mm-hmm. What a different world it would be. Everybody said, well, this would be disastrous to the economy. But what if people accommodated, you know, with this? What if there was a dependency on savings? What if we did have a market rate of interest? And what if that resulted in less bubbles? You know, all of a sudden mm-hmm. the world would be a different place. But no, they believe it, but they're protecting themselves now by willingness to blame somebody else that, you know, won't ever be the Federal Reserve. It's going to be some politician that didn't vote to spend enough money and run up the deficit faster.
Now, Dr. Paul, if I had taken you 10 years ago and fast-forwarded you to today and showed you that the Federal Reserve was monetizing about half of all the federal debt, would you believe me?
Well, I probably would have been skeptical, but in many ways, you know, some of the predictions early on that I read about, even in the 60s and the 70s, I remember looking at this and they say, when you have a system like this, every time there's a slump, which you can predict will come, it will always require more spending, more deficits, and more inflation to come out of that recession until, you know, the whole thing falls apart. And this has been so true. So, yes, it looks huge, but you know, right now, they claim we have an end of recession. Most of us don't really believe that. But let's say this so-called recovery ends and we really take another big dip. The only thing they can do is even spend more and more money. So that's the only tool they have. So that, for that reason, I'm shocked at the numbers. I guess I'm more surprised that the whole thing holds together so long. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at this and you look at the foreign debt and the national debt, it is so outrageous, and there's still confidence in the dollar. You know, the world, you know, they don't have a good currency, so the best they can come up with is the dollar, but even the dollar is less popular than it used to be. It is being held a lot less now as reserve currency. But we can still, you know, buy oil, and we can still buy our stuff from China, and they take our currency. But what amazes me is that it holds together. So I think monetizing debt and spending and deficit is going to get much, much worse until the world rejects the dollar. And there will be a rejection here at home in that prices will soar and eventually interest rates will break loose and they'll start rising.
Well, with that final date with destiny and the world turns away from the dollar, what is it that they turn towards?
Well, they can hardly – they pressed me a few times on TV over the years about that. And I said, well, one thing is I don't think the euro is going to replace the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly looks like it's the case. You're not going to – you don't go to yen, and you're not going to go to special drawing rights. The IMF can't come up with a paper currency. No, when people become frightened, they look for things of real value. And I don't think they can repeal the laws of economics that says that for 6,000 years, metals have been beneficial. They will go to monetary metals, gold and silver, and they will buy other things. You know, it's buying property, you know. But, you know, no matter what we have, whether we have our gold coins or we have our property, if we have an authoritarian government, that is our greatest threat. So I'd like to think that there is no perfect protection other than shrinking the size and scope and power of government so that we can be left alone and take care of ourselves. But I don't think there's another paper currency that they're going to go to unless we're pleasantly surprised in a far eastern country or group of countries, you know, might back their currency with gold. And who knows, that would be very good, because certainly the Western civilization and the Western countries are on the downslope, where in the Far East they're still, you know, doing well. Can you imagine what would have happened if China and a few other countries got together and say that, you know, we're going to buy up the gold and we're going to defend our currency? You know, that could change the world rather quickly.
Well, they might be, you know, smart like a fox over there, because certainly China's gold purchases have just been extraordinary over the past several quarters and ever since they opened up gold ownership to their private citizens. So one of the things I'm tracking is a very pronounced from west to east flow of gold, east including India. So it looks like that real wealth of the world is already tilting and rolling to one side of the table from the other.
Yeah, it's been going on. Do you remember? I'm sure you recall when the British sold their gold, at $300 an ounce. And I remember Bernanke, it was Greenspan, and I asked him about it. It was, you know, when it was happening, it was in the news. I said, you know, the British are selling their gold right now, and they're getting $300. I said, that doesn't sound very smart, does it? And he said he was sort of indignant. He says, they know what they're doing. They were smart enough to know what they were doing, but now we look back, they were selling at 300, and I think it's a little bit higher right now.
Well, I want to turn quickly now to something where you mentioned, which is actually very serious to me, is this idea that one of the larger threats we can have is the idea that the government is going to do everything for us, and the government's subsumed for itself the role of being our ultimate savior and protector of all things, and even promising to make us safe in all moments. The problem is we have to trade away our civil liberties for our security. There, and I've got air quotes up when I'm saying that. I know this is a big concern to you. I know you know the players in Capitol Hill making the decisions. I was very interested to see what happened in Boston. Should we take from that event, but also the larger trend of our civil liberties and our privacies just being cut? Like every week, it seems I read about some new encroachment.
Well, we have a choice. We can look at it and say that this was atrocious. It was martial law. It was overkill. It's totally un-American to do what they did. and that we put our foot down and say no more of this, the Fed should stay out and the states should do a better job, or the other way that we might look at it, and I'm afraid it could happen, is, oh, okay, yeah, this was necessary, we do need to be safe and accept this, and I think it's up for grabs. I remember so many times right after 9/11, fighting for civil liberties was very, very difficult, and I'd have, you know, individuals on the street and some constituents come up and say, yeah, I know, we have to, you know, we have to give up some of our freedoms to be safe. And they don't have the right understanding that governments aren't there to make us safe. It sounds like a wonderful thing. But, you know, you can't have a policeman in our house every day, and we can't, you know, to make us safe. They can't physically do it, and if they try to do it, it's a sacrifice of liberty. So if we accept the role of government not to protect our liberties, but to make us safe physically, that means that we have to give up the privacy of our homes, and we have to endorse preemptive war. And also, if you want to be safe and secure materially, then you have to have a welfare state, which bankrupts the country. So those are the attitudes that have to be changed, and this is what we have to do, is we have to develop a whole new generation, and where I do get encouragement, a lot of young people realize this, that government has failed. This is the wonderful news. The IRS is failing, the government is failing, the wars are failing, so we have to have something else, and that's why we have to work so hard to present the case for self-reliance. Not only because we're freer, but we're richer, too. I always said I would opt for a free society if I could just do what I want, nobody messing around with me, and I have my freedom. I said, even if I had a lot less money, that's what I want. But you never have to make that choice. If you demand your freedom, accept your freedom, and if you assume responsibility, believe it or not, we're all going to be better off for it. The country will be richer, and it'll be safer, and it's going to be more peaceful. But we have to be convinced, and the majority have to be convinced to go along with those who will lead us in that direction and say liberty is worth everything it's met up to be, and that we could all be better off with it.
Well, this is the heart of the topic for me here, because a lot of the people I talk to are hungry for liberty. They are ready, willing, and able to assume more responsibility for their personal outcome. We have a large percentage of non-affiliated and independent voters who listen to this podcast. They're all hungry to have better agency in influencing our elected leaders to focus on these issues of economic stewardship, sound money, civil liberty, freedom. What advice do you have to offer them? How can they make a difference? Is it at all inside the political sphere, or is it time to go grassroots on this whole thing?
Well, I think the politics of it, if you start and think the politics are the answers, then it won't work. People in politics are a reflection of attitudes, so it's getting people's attitudes to be changed. And when those attitudes are changed, the government will be changed. But too often, the people accept these things without realizing how dangerous it is, you know, that government is going to take care of us, and they can't possibly do it. And we had a taste of this in our early history. You know, there was a lot of self-reliance. And, you know, the real sad part right now is there is a pretty good work ethic in this country. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes there are individuals who are begging and pleading for a better life, and they come into our country and they get blamed for all the problems that we have. And they end up working hard. And others, because of the welfare state, you know, are too content to accept the welfare and not accept the responsibility of taking care of oneself.
Well, excellent. So final question here. I know your last term as a U.S. House of Representative ended earlier this year. In April, you founded the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Love the title. You also publish a regular newsletter called Ron Paul's Freedom Report. What are the ways in which those who are interested in following your work in your new post-congressional career can do so?
Well, right now, the easiest way, if they want to use the telephone, is 800-RON-PAUL, and you can find out a whole lot. The other thing is there are several web pages, but the one that's the most active right now is Campaign for Liberty. Mm-hmm. Campaign for Liberty is a group that I have in Alexandria. It's a grassroots effort. But through those two efforts, you can find out where all the other websites are.
Well, fantastic. I think I'll have an opportunity to meet you in Phoenix. I'm presenting at the Casey conference there this year as well. So hopefully I can run into you there. I want to thank you so much for your time and most importantly for all the work you're currently doing and all the work you've done in service for freedom. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.